Welcome to EI Talks, a podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm delighted to say that here in Washington, D.C., I'm joined by Mary Serotta, who is the Kravis Distinguished Professor of Historical Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Welcome, Mary. We're delighted to have you here.
Lovely to be here.
And we're here principally to discuss your remarkable book, which has received great acclaim, Not One Inch, America, Russia, and the Making of the Post-Cold War Stalemate, whose roots in terms of research and your relationship to American, Western, Russian relations goes back a long way to just before, round about Berlin in 1989, an epical moment. And I just wondered about the creation of this book, because it's a long time in gestation. And I just wanted to make it clear how it came about and how you acquired that knowledge, that scholarship, that resource, and became a particular noted expert in this place and this time.
Sure, happy to do that. And also let me praise Engelsberg for its dedication to serious discussion of historical topics and their significance for the modern world. I value that greatly about Engelsberg Ideas. So
well,
it's
thank you.
Great to be here. Yeah, I was studying abroad in a place called West Berlin in 1989, and a few things happened. And so that was obviously a life-changing experience, and I decided to study history and politics as a result of it. I went on, as one would expect, to work on the history of the Berlin Wall coming down, and I wrote a book called The Collapse. I did another book as well on the foreign policy of German unification called 1989. In the course of researching those books, I stumbled over documents that at the time people were saying didn't exist, which were documents about the connection between German unification and NATO enlargement. Mm-hmm. And again, at the time, people were saying, oh, no, that doesn't exist. That doesn't happen until much later. And I thought, well, that's very strange because I'm seeing these documents. So I was initially, as I said, working on the Berlin Wall coming down and unification. But I started keeping a file, both digital and real, of these documents. And at some point, I thought, you know, I think this might be a topic in and of itself. And by 2005, I started filing Freedom of Information Act requests. At first piecemeal, but then increasingly over the years more and more seriously, to get documents on this topic. So in essence, I was creating my own private archive in addition to using documents that were available just through regular declassification. Yep. And that process was incremental and took a very long time. Now, obviously, I'm a professor. I was doing other things. I wasn't doing this full time. But I just kept it alive. I wrote the odd article. And finally, when we got into the teens in 2015, I realized that if I wanted to do the topic seriously, I needed documents not just from the late 80s, but also from the 90s. And so I began filing requests for documents in particular from the Clinton Presidential Library.
Yeah.
And in 2018, I had a huge breakthrough. After 3 years of appeal, I got nearly all of the documents from the 18 summits between U.S. President Bill Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin released. Yeah. And when that happened, the Kremlin complained. Dmitry Peskov, Putin's spokesman, complained that these documents should not have been released because they included information about currently serving politicians, meaning, of course, his boss, Vladimir Putin. And so I thought, okay, if the Kremlin is complaining,
you're onto something.
Exactly. The documents must be good. And I was not disappointed. So I got this, you know, an enormous amount of documents. So now it's about 2019 or so, and I'm realizing, okay, after all these years of collecting documents, I finally have enough. So when am I actually going to publish this book that I've been thinking about for so long? In the course of my research, I noticed a truly distressing pattern, which is that Vladimir Putin is obsessed with history, is obsessed with historical dates, and likes to, quote unquote, celebrate some of them with violence. What do I mean by this? Well, on his birthday, for example, dissidents tend to end up dead. One of the most famous, Anna Politkovskaya, a very brave woman and journalist who was one of the few people still able to report from Chechnya on the war and war crimes there. Chechnya, of course, being a war that Putin largely ran. She was shot dead while carrying home groceries on October 7th, 2006, Putin's birthday. He gave a speech after that where he referred to this as the murder of an extremely insignificant woman. Fast forward 10 years, the release of emails hacked from the Hillary Clinton campaign, they're dropped on October 7th, 2016, Putin's birthday. And we could sit here and I could go through a long list of events, both on his birthday and on Soviet anniversaries. And I realized that he likes, in some ways, to mark these events. Now, I don't know if he just orders people straight out to do these things or if he says, oh, who will rid me of this terrible honor woman? I don't know, but the result is the same. These things happen, keyed to certain dates. So I looked at my calendar, so and it's now 2019. I have enough documents. I looked at my calendar and I realized coming up in 2021, December 2021 to be precise, was the 30th anniversary of Ukraine pulling away from Moscow's control and of the Soviet Union collapsing and of all the chaos that follows from 1991, 1992. And I wasn't psychic. I didn't have any particular idea what he would do. I just had a conviction that he would be unable to ignore that anniversary. Yeah. And so I decided to publish the book in the U.S. in December 2021 and in the U.K. in February 2022. Minor side note, I realized, because I had so much material, at some point I realized about late 2019, early 2020, I thought, by God, the only way I'm going to get this done in time is if I cancel everything on my calendar for the year 2020 and just work on it. And then the pandemic helped me out there.
Right. Okay. No.
So thanks to the pandemic, I was able to meet my deadlines and the book appeared. And then, of course, sadly, Putin was unable to ignore that anniversary. And he started saying in press conferences and things, he started saying, not one inch, the title of the book. Yeah. And my life has really been, I need to caveat this. The people whose lives have become truly surreal is, of course, the Ukrainians. And I would like to express my profound admiration for the Ukrainians, for their bravery and their courage. So what I've experienced is, in no way comparable with that. But my life has, in small measure, become very surreal since December 21st, since I published the book and since everything that has followed.
And that title that you refer to, Not One Inch, is really at the heart of the book. Because, what were you trying to achieve with the book? What was the story you wanted to tell? And then tell us about the importance of that title.
Yes. So I, with this story, wanted to bring evidence and empiricism to a very emotional debate. I think that's where scholars can add value. These questions about what did the West tell Russia about NATO enlargement, these aren't eternal mysteries. These were diplomatic negotiations. Participants wrote things down. Yeah. They put them in their files. The files have been held in a safe manner in archives since then. It is possible using historical methods to reconstruct a narrative of events. We don't just need to, make assumptions. Now, obviously, everything isn't written down, but it's very difficult to run a country, and especially its foreign policy, without writing a large number of things down. So I wanted to use the skills that I had as a historian. I trained at Yale with Paul Kennedy, Sir Michael Howard, Jeffrey Parker, all of them British, by the way.
Jeffrey's a good friend.
I had a British education in the United States. And I wanted to use these skills and bring them to bear on this question because this is something that is tractable by historical methods. Mm. And what I feel like is happening now, let me put it this way, I would ideally like it if the Russians in Ukraine would lay down their weapons and go home. But I cannot personally disarm them. But Putin is trying to use this specific history as a weapon as well. And I feel like in that small way, I can help to disarm him because I know the evidence on this topic. So that's the general context. Specifically on the title, as as many of your listeners may know, the debate over what the West promised or did not promise Russia over NATO enlargement centers on an event during the process of German unification. Now, I need to give a little bit of background to explain the significance of this event. It's important to recall that divided Germany, when the wall came down, was still an occupied country. There had been some modifications made to the terms, but essentially Germany was still an occupied country, occupied by the victor powers of World War II.
Because it was an unconditional surrender.
Because in 1945, Nazi Germany had surrendered unconditionally, exactly. That didn't include any deadlines. Unconditionally meant unconditionally. So it was still occupied by the U.S., the British, the French, and the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And in order for Germany to unify, all four of those countries had to give permission, period. Yeah. So the Soviet Union needed to allow Germany to unify it had these basically rock-solid legal rights. And as if that weren't enough, the Soviet Union had roughly 400,000 troops in East Germany. So there is no way that Germany can unify without the Soviet Union renouncing its occupation control and pulling back its troops. Yeah. So the question is, what are you going to bargain with? And the West then, of course, engaged, as one would, into lots of speculation about what will Gorbachev want. And at some early stage, the West German foreign minister in particular, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, but a number of others as well, said, well, you know what Gorbachev might want. He might want the security of knowing that NATO isn't going to expand to Poland and Hungary. And I was really surprised because this is, I'm talking now about February 1990, and Genscher is talking about NATO enlarging or not enlarging to Poland and Hungary, so not just East Germany. Mm. Now, Genscher was saying that as an argument for promising it wouldn't happen. Genscher was in favor of not only blocking NATO enlargement, but actually for NATO and the Warsaw Pact to both dissolve and for a new pan-European security organization to replace them. Yeah. And Genscher talked about that quite a bit, which is why there's confusion in the record. But ultimately, Genscher was not running West Germany and he was not running the United States. No. Before it became clear that the people who were running those countries, George H.W. Bush in the U.S. and Helmut Kohl, before it became clear that they were opposed to that vision, Genscher and Baker had a number of conversations about it.
And this is James Baker, the Secretary of State.
The U.S. Secretary of State. And in a hypothetical conversation with Mikhail Gorbachev, I emphasize hypothetical, an early round where they're talking about possibilities, Baker mentions this to Gorbachev. So roughly speaking, I'm paraphrasing, but all the exact quotations are in my book, Not One Inch. Baker is in Moscow, February 9th, 1990. He's speaking with Gorbachev. And he says, they're trying to figure out ways to move forward on German unification. The wall has come down. It's clear Germans want to unify. The question is, what will Moscow want in exchange? And so Baker is discussing possibilities, and he says, how about this, question mark? How about, in essence, you let your part of Germany go, and we say that NATO will move its jurisdiction not one inch eastward? And Gorbachev says, yes, that sounds about right. Certainly NATO shouldn't be moving eastwards. We should talk more about that. But there's nothing formalized or agreed. Then James Baker goes back to his boss, an old friend, tennis doubles partner, George H.W. Bush, and gives a report of what happened. And Bush says to Baker, ooh, that was a mistake. You're going to need to walk that back. I don't agree with that. I don't think we need to negotiate over NATO's future. To hell with that. We prevailed. They didn't. And we're going to need to find something else. The problem is that Genscher has been saying this. The Germans have been saying this. So George H.W. Bush needs to not only shut down what Baker is saying, he needs to shut down what the Germans are saying. So he then invites the German leader, Helmut Kohl, to Camp David, since he can't just order Kohl around. So he's going to sweet talk him in front of a roaring fire after a good meal. And he says to Kohl, roughly the same, he said, you know, I don't think we should be negotiating over NATO's future. To hell with that. And then Kohl says, okay, but we still got to give Moscow something. And if we're not going to talk about NATO, then it will probably come down to a question of cash. And George H.W. Bush responds, you have deep pockets.
So it's essentially a bribe.
And the future Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who was actually at that point a more junior official, Deputy National Security Advisor, in his memoirs said, at that moment, the U.S. strategy arose. It was, and this is, I'm quoting Gates here, it was bribing the Soviets out. And that it, what Gates said is correct, that it was a strategy, it worked. So this question about putting a brake on NATO enlargement just disappears from the negotiations. The Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, doesn't notice for a while, and then when he tries to get it reinserted, he can't. And ultimately what he signs, the treaty that leads to German unification, that treaty includes no break on NATO enlargement. Indeed, it expressly allows the opposite. It allows NATO to move eastward across the former Cold War front line, which ran through the middle of Germany. It allows NATO to move across that former front line, to move into East Germany, to extend Article 5 to East Germany. And Moscow not only signs this treaty, not only ratifies it, but also cashes the associated check, which Helmut Kohl, the man with the deep pockets, wrote.
Yeah.
So that is the final legal result. So when I was writing the book, I thought, you know, boy, at the end, everybody's going to hate me because there's the hardline Western position that none of this happened, none of it came up. The Russians are just making it up out of whole cloth. And then there's the hardline Russian position, which is we were absolutely in a binding way, promised no expansion, we were absolutely betrayed. And what happened, according to the evidence, was somewhere in between. It came up, but what is legally valid, what resulted at the end, does not contain any kind of break or pledge. And I thought, boy, both sides are going to be mad at me because it's not consistent with either of these views. Yeah. I also realized that that phrase, not one inch, had a broader significance as the story unfolds. Because first you have this debate over NATO moving not one inch eastward. But then as NATO expansion gains momentum, the meaning shifts and the U.S. feels that not one inch of Europe should be off limits to NATO. And then we start to get into the new era of challenge and confrontation because you then start to have the open door and unlimited NATO enlargement.
Yeah.
And that's a different story because that's where I shift from talking about the origins to looking at the modalities. In other words, looking at how NATO enlarged and the problems that that caused.
And that's fascinating, seeing that expansion, because there's some tension there between the US and UK
yes.
over that.
Yes.
In that it's kind of endless open door of expansion that the Americans buy into or
yes.
they promote.
Yes.
And UK diplomats, British diplomats are talking about a single event.
Yes.
So you have a tension. Can you just explain that, Mary? I thought it was really interesting.
Sure.
Those two, you know, they're allies.
Yes.
But they have competing visions.
Yes.
Of how to deal with Soviet Union or Russia, as it became.
And the British position, I think, was a very savvy one. And I think Washington would have been well served to pay more attention to it. Yes. Just by way of background for your readers, before I answer your specific question, it's important to state that I am a supporter of NATO enlargement.
Yeah.
I believe that when the wall came down, when the Poles bravely resisted Soviet authoritarianism, created a new democracy, the Czechs, all yeah. those countries, they deserved the right, the sovereign right, to become democratic countries and to choose their own security alliances.
Yeah.
And they chose NATO, and NATO enlarged, and I am a supporter of that.
And Article 5 works.
And Article 5 works, in my opinion. So my problem is not with NATO enlargement. My problem is with how
yeah.
it happened,
yeah.
with how it happened. What becomes clear when you look at the historical record is that there was not one kind of NATO enlargement. There were all kinds of debates, sometimes quite ferocious, over how to enlarge NATO. And as part of those debates, the British weighed in, as you said, and I think actually in a very smart way. So moving forward now into the Clinton era, East Germany is now part of NATO. The Central and Eastern European countries are asking to get in urgently. So it's very much a demand-driven process because they very much want to be in NATO. So the question is, should we do it? And if so, how many countries? And the British, London at the time, this is now the mid-90s, said, well, you know, Russia is not always going to be as weak as it is now. So what we should do right now is we should have one giant round of NATO enlargement, take in every possible candidate, and then even though we won't say this out loud, de facto cease enlarging. Because if we just keep enlarging and enlarging, we're going to eventually run up against the Russian border and have friction, and also this iterative process will seem threatening. We should really think twice about that. The American response, largely authored by President Clinton's old friend and Russia advisor, Stroke Talbot, yeah. was that is exactly the opposite of what we should do. We need to start an iterative process. That's exactly what we should do. We need to have an open door that's going to stay open for as long as possible. We need to make clear that not one inch of Europe can't become part of NATO. So what we need to do is start with the smallest possible number of members, because if we take a lot of people, it'll look like we're done.
Yeah.
So we need to take the smallest possible numbers, and it ends up being just Poland, Hungary, and half a country, the Czech Republic, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, obviously, it had been divided by then, but it was you know, clear that the next step is going to be Slovakia. So that it's abundantly clear to everyone that there will be more rounds. Mm. And it became apparent to me that even though on the outside we perceive them as separate rounds, they were all part of a consistent strategy to move forward in an iterative fashion across Europe.
And a kind of inevitable process.
And make it seem inevitable and keep moving closer and closer to Russia. And I thought, wow, okay, that is problematic because Russia is not always going to be this weak, and it wasn't. And as Russia resumes its role in Europe and recovers from the traumas of 91 and so forth, you can see an obvious confrontation coming there. Now, I'm not saying this because I think, gee, we should have been nicer to the Russians, they're nice people, or I'm not making an argument. What I'm saying here is there are only two strategic nuclear powers in the world, Washington and Moscow.
And they've got 90% of the...
And they've still, all these years after the end of the Cold War, have 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. So anything that increases friction between them is not in our interest, is not in the planet's interest. Yeah. So I'm not saying, oh, we should do this just to, you know, be nice. I'm saying, if you really think big picture, that was a moment where the nuclear threat was greatly reduced. In fact, the 1990s were the moment of the greatest nuclear disarmament and destruction since the invention of the atomic bomb. And you wanted to keep that moment going as long as possible. That's in the interest of the US, Europe, the whole planet. So any obvious source of friction at this precious moment where you can, you know, take the world back from the nuclear brink is really something to be avoided. And I'm not the only one who thought this. There were people who recognized it at the time in, of all places, the American Pentagon. I interviewed the American Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, a very, very smart man. And he would go to President Clinton and say, I know you want to enlarge NATO, and I think we should, but we have to be very careful about how we do it. Because I, Bill Perry, you know, my job is to make the United States safe, keep it safe. And I'm doing a great job because I'm working hand in hand with Moscow and Kyiv to not only take out of service, but dismantle and destroy weapons pointed at American cities. So anything we do that increases friction with Moscow is simply not in our interest. And so Bill Perry at the Pentagon, along with some others at the U.S. mission to NATO, the National Security Council, said, you know what we should do is we need to make the process of enlargement, we need to do it in a more face-saving manner for Russia. Again, because of the nuclear issue, not just because we should be nice. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is not have this steady march of NATO's border closer to Russia's border. We need to make it more diffuse. We need some kind of intermediate organization, and gradually we can add countries, they can join this intermediate organization, it will give them a chance to become interoperable with NATO, which a lot of them aren't, and then gradually as they do well at becoming interoperable, we can pick one country here, pick one country there, rather than this imposing geographical march. And that, I think, was a sound idea. And like also the British idea, I think that was a sound idea. And I don't think it would have meant that everything now would be wine and roses between the West and Russia, but I think it would have ended us in a spot that was less confrontational. Now, that's a low bar, because the spot we're in right now is very confrontational.
Yeah. But it's significant.
Yeah,
it's,
I think it would, yes. Here we get to a little bit of the theory that I use in the book. And to your listeners, don't worry, I'll explain it. It's not too complicated. I draw on a theory from evolutionary biology called punctuated equilibrium.
Yeah.
This came from when I was an undergraduate at Harvard. I had the good fortune to have a class with the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould, a marvelous author. If your listeners are interested in his writings, I recommend them warmly. And roughly speaking, his theory was as follows. I, Stephen Jay Gould, as an evolutionary biologist, when I go look at the fossil record, right, when I go look at rocks, I do not, in fact, see in the fossil record, a little change one day, and then a little change another day, and then a little change another day. In other words, I do not actually see gradualism. What I see are long periods where relatively little changes, so long periods of stasis or equilibrium, and then a sudden, dramatic, or as he put it, punctuational event. Of course, one famous one being when 65 million years ago, an asteroid slams into the Earth, throws up so much debris, causes so much volcanic activity that it actually changes the atmosphere, casts, you know, dense layers of ash up into the atmosphere. They cool the Earth below the level at which dinosaurs can survive. That's a punctuational moment. Mm-hmm. And punctuational moments are where contingency comes to the fore and dramatic change is possible. And I realized, wow, that actually is very helpful for me in understanding these punctuational moments in history, because you have these long periods of stasis like the Cold War, and then you have a dramatic event like the Berlin Wall coming down, and suddenly there's multiple paths to the future that are possible, right? Agency and contingency comes into play, and decisions made that actors make in that contingent moment have an outsized impact. And so I use that to argue that this moment, where this precious moment where you had the end of the Western confrontation with Russia, a new possibility for cooperation, that moment had many potential outcomes. And sadly, if you look at all the timelines coming out of that moment, we're on one of the darkest. So I'm not saying everything would be perfect, but I believe we would be on a less dark timeline.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mary. I can't recommend your book enough, not one inch. not just because it tells a fascinating story remarkably well, and I found it quite moving, but also, I think, because of its genuine historiographical originality as well. So, it deserves all the plaudits it's got. So, Professor Serrato, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honored to talk to you.